Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith.
The case against Troy Davis, when compared to other death penalty cases across the country, is extraordinarily weak.
The state of Georgia has announced plans to execute Troy Davis on September 21st, in spite of massive international support for his campaign to prove his innocence in the murder of Georgia policeman Mark McPhail. We're joined by award-winning filmmaker and author Jen Marlowe and Georgia State University law professor Anne Emanuel. We asked Jen Marlowe about the meaning of the new date and if there's still time to save Troy Davis's life.
Absolutely. And in fact, the setting of the execution date actually sets into motion the clemency process. There's a board in Georgia, the Georgia Board of Pardons and Parole, and the expectation is that they will grant Troy a clemency hearing. And the Board of Pardons and Parole, unlike a court, which is bound by procedure and bound by having to do the quote-unquote correct things from a procedural point of view, the Board of Pardons and Parole is not a court. It's not a legal body in the same way. They're able to make choices based on what is the ethical thing to do, what is the right thing to do. And so we have a lot of hope that the Board of Pardons and Parole in Georgia will see that in Troy's case, there's overwhelming doubt and there's significant questions as to Troy Davis's guilt. I would say more than significant questions. And so there is a lot of hope that they will do the right thing and they will grant Troy clemency, which basically means mercy. And it means taking him off of death row. They can commute his sentence and they can commute it to life without parole in prison, which certainly is not what Troy wants ultimately. He has always maintained his innocence, and so he does not want to be in prison for life without parole. But of course, you can eventually free a wrongfully convicted man from prison, but if he is executed, you can't free him from the grave. So we have great hope that the Board of Pardons and Parole will grant him clemency. And that's really where all our efforts are focused right now, on trying to let the board know that there's thousands and thousands of people worldwide who are watching this case, who are very concerned about the possibility of an execution proceeding when there is so much doubt. And there's thousands of people worldwide urging the board to grant Troy clemency.
Now, Troy Davis, if I remember correctly, has been near death by execution something like three times in the past. Is that right?
That is correct. This is his fourth execution date. In 2007, he came within 23 hours of execution. In 2008, he came within 90 minutes. And then there was another date following that in 2008, which was also stayed. So this will be the fourth time that Troy is facing an execution date and the fourth time that his family is dealing with what it means that he's facing an execution date. What's different about this date is that there is nothing in the hopper, quote unquote, legally speaking. Troy's final appeal was denied by the U.S. Supreme Court on March 28th. So what led to the previous stays was the fact that there were still appeals being considered, things that had been filed in different court systems, and that is what led to many of the previous stays. That's not going to be the case this time. It's not a stay that we're looking for, but it's actual clemency. It's taking Troy Davis off of death row because of the fact that there is such significant doubt that he was involved in the murder for which he was convicted.
And were the entire group of people that have changed their mind about Troy Davis's guilt to come forward and participate in a protest tomorrow, it would be a sizable number of people, wouldn't it?
And people have come forth. In fact, there was a juror who was one of the jurors in Troy's trial in 1991, and obviously the jury had found Troy guilty and had sentenced him to death. And on CNN a few years ago, that juror came out and said, "If I knew then what I know now, Troy Davis would not be on death row. The verdict would be not guilty." So it's enormously helpful that jurors have spoken up, that witnesses have publicly recanted. There's no physical evidence that links Troy to the murder. Troy's conviction was based on eyewitness testimony. And seven out of the nine eyewitnesses who testified against Troy have since recanted. Many of them citing police coercion and intimidation as to why they had initially implicated Troy. Several other witnesses have come forth and implicated another shooter. That man who's been implicated is one of the two witnesses who has not recanted against Troy. So there's been many, many people that have come forth and spoken up and said something very wrong happened at that trial, and people who were directly involved in that trial have spoken up and said that. And in terms of what you're talking about demonstrations and people rallying, Amnesty International is right now in the process of organizing an international day of a global day of solidarity for Troy Davis. And I hope listeners will check in at the website, which is justicefortroy.org, because all the information about when this day will be, all of that is being planned as we speak.
And we'll link to the film you've made about the Troy Davis case on our website, talknationradio.org. Why don't you tell us why you felt so strongly about this case, and why you've become active in making the film and working on it and staying involved?
I heard Troy's sister, Martina, speak on Democracy Now!, which was right after Troy had survived his first execution date. And I'd never heard about Troy's case before. And I'm very concerned about the death penalty overall anyway, and in terms of how it is applied and the egregious errors that often get made, in our criminal justice system. So I had very clear opinions about the death penalty to begin with, but I hadn't heard about Troy's case, and hearing his sister talk about it and hearing his sister talk about her experience of fighting for Troy's life, her experience having to say goodbye to her brother ahead of that first execution date when they didn't know he would get a stay. So I looked into more information, and like with so many other issues, things that our mainstream media aren't offering us, if you know to look for it, if you know to dig for it, then you can find more information. And so as I was digging, I found the report that Amnesty International had just recently released about Troy's case. I read as much as I could, and I found a website with an address for Troy in prison, and I wrote him a card, and he wrote back, and that's how we started corresponding, and that led to me meeting his family, his incredible family in Savannah, Georgia, all of them just shoulder to shoulder fighting for Troy and fighting for justice. And once you get a human face put on any human rights atrocity, any human rights injustice, for me, at least, it becomes impossible not to take a stand. To me, the most natural next step, whatever the issue is that I'm working on, whether it's working on Troy's case and on death penalty issues, whether it's working in Palestine or in Sudan, for me, the question I always ask myself is, what can I bring to help? And whether that's using skills as a filmmaker or writing or organizing or just supporting people who need support, it's whatever I can bring to the table, I try to bring. And actually, if folks do go to the justicefortroy.org site and get information about the actions, including a petition that there is to sign, there's also a four-part video series that I made with Amnesty over the last couple weeks, which really unpacks in great detail the details of Troy's case and examines exactly what we mean when we say there's too much doubt to execute.
What about the date of September 21st as an execution date for Troy Davis? Do you think that the date was chosen for any meaning? I mean, it's coming up very quickly. Did that surprise you? And does that suggest anything to you about the court and their process here?
We were expecting the date to be announced any time after Labor Day. It was clear that Troy would be safe during the month of August because the Georgia Supreme Court was on recess in the month of August. But we've been waiting for the date to be set since towards the end of May. And the reason it wasn't set earlier than that was that Georgia, as well as other states that execute via lethal injection, had their supply of one of the drugs confiscated that they use. States usually use a three-drug cocktail to lethally inject. And one of the drugs, sodium thiopental, the federal government confiscated Georgia's supply of sodium thiopental and then subsequently confiscated other state supplies because it was uncovered that it had been illegally obtained. And so for a bit of time, that kind of threw a wrench, in the execution cog, and it gummed up states' abilities to execute. And there was a scramble for a few months while states were figuring out what they were going to use to replace their now missing supply of sodium thiopental. So Georgia, on May 18th, announced that it was switching from sodium thiopental to another drug called pentobarbital, and a few other states had already announced their switch before Georgia did, also to pentobarbital, which incidentally is what is used to put animals to sleep. Since the time that Georgia announced that switch, which was May 18th, so between May 18th and the end of July, two other prisoners had already been executed in the state of Georgia. One of them is thought to have possibly been a botched execution. The pentobarbital, which is supposed to numb the prisoner, was thought not to have worked in the case of one of the executions, and there was witnesses reported signs that he was actually in agony. But Georgia is proceeding ahead with executions and proceeding ahead with doing it with pentobarbital. So two people were executed in Georgia during June and July, and now Troy is the first person slated after the recess.
And Jen Marlowe, I know you're working on your third book, actually, with Troy Davis's sister. Is that right?
That's correct. It is Martina's book. It is Martina's story, and it's her double struggle, both for her brother's life, because her tireless advocacy on Troy's behalf just for decades, calling out about his innocence, revealing how the case against him has unraveled. I mean, that's really what caught the attention of the human rights organization and the media and the very passionate coalition that is behind Troy's case now that never would have come into existence without Martina being out there on the forefront for years and years and years. But she's also fighting for her own life. It's a double struggle for Troy's life and for her own life, because 10 years ago, Martina was diagnosed with stage 4 breast cancer. And at the time she was diagnosed, she was given 6 months to live. Her cancer had already metastasized so far that her liver was covered in breast cancer tumors. And now it's 10 years later. Martina is still very ill, and she is still fighting fiercely for both her brother's life and her own life. So the book is telling her story of her double struggle.
Jen Marlowe, just talk about the petitions that are available online. I know a lot of listeners may have participated in their own states in protests, and some of them wearing those blue T-shirts that say on the front, you know, I am Troy Davis.
The logo, I am Troy Davis, I think is a very meaningful one, because the idea that it's a matter of circumstance and that any of us could be going through what Troy and what his family are going through right now, and that the problem is not just in Troy's case alone, but it's a much larger systemic problem. And it's a problem that can never be solved as long as we have the death penalty in this country. And I very much encourage folks to go to the website and take various forms of actions. JusticeForTroy.org is where they should go. There's an online petition they can sign, which is basically calling out to the Georgia Board of Pardons and Parole and saying there's too much doubt to execute, and asking them to grant Troy clemency. For any legal professionals who may be listening, lawyers, law professors, there's a special sign-on letter for legal professionals to the Board of Pardons and Parole that can also be accessed at the same website, justiceforTroy.org. That's Amnesty USA's website for actions related to Troy. And for religious professionals, members of the clergy of any faith, there's also a special sign-on letter for them to endorse. And all of that can be found at justiceforTroy.org, as well as updated information about when the Global Day of Solidarity for Troy will be held, and ideas and sample actions that folks can take to organize something in their community, because we really want to make sure that ahead of this parole board hearing, that the Georgia Board of Pardons and Paroles knows full well that people all over the world in every community, from Savannah, Georgia, to all over the U.S., internationally, are watching and are extremely concerned about the possibility of an innocent man being executed.
You're listening to Talk Nation Radio. Back in 2007, we spoke with the original prosecutor in the Davis case and asked him whether or not he had conducted an investigation into Sylvester Red Coles, who had been at the scene of the killing and a person of suspicion to many studying the case in the years since. You mentioned this other man, Sylvester Coles.
Mm-hmm.
Did you investigate Sylvester Coles at the time, 1989?
Yes. Well, I don't know what you're going to be willing to call an investigation, but what happened is he came, I think it was the day after the event. He produced himself to the police. I think maybe I had said this in the material you're looking at.
Well, you made the point that he had an attorney, but his attorney allowed him to appear before the police without his being present. Why was that important?
Well, because it indicates some confidence on the part of the lawyer that Coles was not involved. And as I said, if any lawyer who had even the tiniest notion that his client could be tied to the case, whether justifiably or not, would never allow him to testify without counsel presence. So, or make a statement to the police without counsel presence. So what that really basically indicates is that the man's own lawyer was sufficiently confident that he could not be tied to it, that he told him, go down there and go to the police station and tell them anything. Tell them whatever it is that you know that you've got to say. So he did.
Jen Marlowe, a former DA and Sheriff Spencer Lawton in Chatham County, Georgia, told us about his quote-unquote investigation into Sylvester Red Coles, you know, maybe limited by the fact that Coles was quote-unquote allowed to come and speak with the sheriff's office without attorney.
Well, no, he actually came in with his lawyer. Red Coles turned Troy Davis in. He came to the police the day after the murder with his lawyer and told the police that Troy Davis had committed the murder. The fact that the sheriff said that was a reason not to treat Coles as a suspect, I think, is very interesting, because in my mind, that is every reason to be suspicious of Red Coles. Coles came from what could be described as a no-snitch culture. It would be highly unusual for a young black man to voluntarily go to the police to implicate another young black man, unless there was some other motivation he had for doing that. The fact that Coles voluntarily, quote-unquote, snitched to the police should have actually very much been a source of suspicion and should have been one of the reasons why Coles was investigated as a suspect himself. However, it's true that he never was investigated as a suspect from the moment that Coles gave Troy's name to the Savannah Police Department. A process of tunnel vision ensued, which essentially meant that, you know, they had Troy in their sights, they had that name, and it's a natural, it's a normal human process that happens with tunnel vision, where you begin to look for and hear and see whatever clues or whatever pieces of evidence fit within that tunnel vision and ignore, you know, don't correctly interpret whatever other clues or pieces of evidence point away from where your tunnel is directed. And in this case, they had Sylvester Coles gave them Troy's name. Their tunnel was focused in Troy, and everything in the investigation from that point on served to reinforce that, because they were only looking for the things or seeing the things that reinforced that and not seeing or ignoring things that pointed away from Troy and even pointed towards Red Coles himself. For example, the fact that Red Coles had been seen the evening of the murder, a little bit before the murder took place, with a .38 caliber weapon, the same kind of gun that was used to gun down Officer Mark McPhail.
Well, Spencer Lawton also turns out to have been wrong when he claimed that none of the witnesses had tried to recant earlier, you know, at or near the trial date. And in fact, during a recorded appeal hearing, the assistant DA, David Locke, said, quote, "There were some witnesses that backed up a little bit at trial." So it's one of those other things that Lawton tends to make a mistake about.
Oh, absolutely. One of the witnesses recanted at trial, and that was Daryl D.D. Collins. And D.D. had been at the site of the crime, because Troy was at the site of the murder shortly before the murder, and D.D. had been there as well as Red Coles. And D.D. recanted at trial. And in D.D.'s case, D.D. had been, I don't remember if he was 15 or 16 years old, and when he was interrogated by the police, they came, they took him out of his house, they interrogated him for hours and hours without his parents present, and he was a minor, and they threatened him that they would make him an accomplice to murder if he didn't sign the statement that they wanted to sign. And Dee Dee actually reveals that not only in his later affidavits that he signed, but there's an interview with him as well on CNN where he comes out and he says, "I told him over and over, I didn't see that happen. They put in that statement what they wanted to put in that statement." And Didi did recant at trial. He came out and said that at trial. So he was the one recantation at trial. And then, of course, more and more and more recantations came out after the trial, after the conviction.
Now, just looking at the list of people who have called for clemency for Troy Davis, the list includes the Pope, former President Jimmy Carter, and also former FBI Director William Sessions, a long and growing list of people who have long felt that the evidence isn't there and that Troy Davis does not deserve to die by, I guess, lethal injection. The date now set for mid-September, the 21st, is being suggested.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's been a very powerful, in the sense of compelling, coalition calling to prevent the execution for Troy. And as you said, William Sessions has called to prevent the execution for Troy. So is former Republican Georgian Congressman Bob Barr. And that's very significant because Bob Barr and William Sessions are not anti-death penalty. What they are saying is that the death penalty should only be applied when there's absolutely no doubt. And in Troy's case, there is significant doubt. Even in the ruling, Troy did have an evidentiary hearing. It was in June 2010. The judge who presided over the ruling, Judge William Moore, ruled against Troy. But in his ruling, he said the state's case against Troy Davis may not be ironclad. Well, no execution should be permitted to go forward if a case is not ironclad. And I would argue that in Troy's case, not only is it not ironclad, but there's overwhelming doubt. One of the problems in our legal system, and one of the reasons why we should never be executing people, is that our system is not really set up to be able to deal with claims of innocence and with wrongful convictions. You're supposed to be innocent until proven guilty and guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. But once you are convicted of a crime, then it switches. Then the burden of proof is on you. So since his 1991 conviction, Troy has been in the position of having to prove his innocence, which in many ways is proving a negative. And people think that, oh, there's a long appeals process. He's had all these appeals. His case has been reviewed and reviewed court after court, so he's had his fair shot. Well, what most people don't realize is that during the appeals process and during all those reviews, those are set up to look at procedural problems. They're not, that process, the appeals process, is not set up to actually look at an innocence claim. It's not relitigating a case. It's not opening up and examining new evidence. It's looking at whether there were procedural problems during the trial that would be grounds for retrial. New evidence, recantations, none of that even got looked at in a court of law until a year ago. And even then, when it was looked at, it was not a retrial. Troy was not presumed innocent. The burden of proof was on Troy to clearly establish his innocence.
Jen Marlowe is author of Darfur Diaries, also made into an award-winning film, and The Hour of Sunlight, One Palestinian's Journey from Prisoner to Peacemaker. We were also able to reach law professor Anne Emanuel. She teaches criminal law and criminal procedure at Georgia State University School of Law, and she's author of a 2006 report on the death penalty in Georgia. And she is very familiar with the Troy Davis case. Attorney Emanuel, welcome.
Thank you.
If you compare the Troy Davis case with other cases that you're familiar with on a national basis, just how egregious is this case and the execution date now set for September 21st?
I think the case against Troy Davis, when compared to other death penalty cases across the country, is extraordinarily weak. And I think one thing we've lost sight of is it's extraordinarily weak even before you take into account the recantations. It's extraordinarily weak because the evidence at trial is a hodgepodge of identifications and hearsay evidence about a very conflicted incident in the middle of the night in an area where tensions are running extremely high and where racial tensions have to have played a part in it. It's weak from the very beginning because of the nature of some of the identifications that were admitted. The trial court's decision often is to let the jury decide the weight of it. But when you admit a handful of identifications from people who could not really have had any reasonable opportunity to make a firm identification of who in the middle of that dark parking lot at 2 a.m. in the morning was the shooter, it begins to weigh on the jury and to have cumulative effect. And it's extremely weak because there was no physical corroborating evidence. It really was just he said, she said, except for the piece about the bullets. The argument of the state was, we can link Troy Davis, we have linked Troy Davis to an earlier shooting, and we can link those bullets to the bullets that shot and killed Officer McPhail. And now they say, you know, we actually can't. There is no ascertainable link with modern forensic methods. I don't see how you can go forward. And I think one thing that is not commented on enough is how unfair this is to the jury. Obviously, it's unfair to innumerable people. It's unfair to the McPhail family to have this drag on forever and not have had a better resolution and a better trial in the first place. But how you go forward with an execution when the state withdraws a key piece of evidence, and when that key piece of evidence is the only piece of physical evidence that was ever available, it escapes me. It seems to me it shocks the conscience and it can't be allowed to go forward.
I understand you worked on a 2006 report on the death penalty in the state of Georgia, right?
Yes, we did. I was chair of the Georgia Death Penalty Assessment Team, which was put together by the American Bar Association out of its concern for how the death penalty is implemented. And we did look at the problem of race, and we did determine that it was of concern to the team. It's of concern, as a matter of fact, that racial bias plays a role it should not play in implementation of the death penalty. We looked at the problem of not providing appointed counsel, not providing a right to appointed counsel on habeas. We looked at the problem of inadequate defense counsel at trial, which, of course, is perhaps the most serious of all. And we looked even at protocols and methodologies like how the crime labs function. We attempted to take an exhaustive look at the implementation of the death penalty in Georgia.
As we know, there are more people of color in American jails than there are white people. And just comment on the fact that Troy Anthony Davis is an African American.
It's extremely troubling that race plays a part in who gets the death penalty and a part in the implementation of the criminal justice system across the board. With reference to the death penalty, though, the statistics clarify that you are significantly more at risk of getting a death penalty if you murder a white person as opposed to a black person, and also correlate the death penalty with racial bias, which unfortunately is not surprising. That's sort of on a micro level, trying to tease out the absolute numbers. If you look, however, at the Death Penalty Act of states, it's immediately clear that race is likely a serious problem because although 34 or 35 American jurisdictions have a death penalty in place, only around 16 are death penalty active. And in that group, there is a predominance of states in the Deep South and the South that practiced Jim Crow segregation for a full century after Brown versus Board of Education. And just a glance at the regional predominance of the death penalty in those states, I think, gives us a message that we can't ignore.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you very much.
Law Professor Anne Emanuel of Georgia State University served as chair of Georgia's Death Penalty Moratorium Implementation Committee. The work culminated in the publication of Evaluating Fairness and Accuracy in State Death Penalty Systems, the Georgia Death Penalty Assessment Report, also from 2004 to 2006, and we'll provide more of both of these interviews with Jen Marlowe and Attorney Emanuel at our website, talknationradio.org. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. This program was produced in Storrs, Connecticut. Our website, talknationradio.org. Our music is by Fritz Heed.